think you learn the most from your mistakes than you do your successes. You know, you learn the most from your failures, from the deals that you lost and the deals that you win. And what I've learned in my career is I try not to run away from something. I try to run to something. And I think it's important to run to something. And I was just made an emotional decision. I lead with integrity. I didn't feel like I was being managed with integrity. And why it wasn't working for somebody that I wanted to win for.
Our guest today is Steve Goldberg. Steve spent the last 4 years at SalesLoft, where he served as the chief revenue officer and led the organization through their multi-billion-dollar valuation in 2021. He started his sales career back in 1994 and joined Salesforce in 2004, where he personally closed some of the biggest deals in the company's early history. In our conversation, Steve shared amazing stories and lessons learned from his experiences closing those company-making deals and talks about what it takes for others to do the same. I loved hearing Steve's thoughts on what separates good salespeople from great ones, and why truly caring about what you're selling is the great unlock, whether or not you're in sales. Steve brings a passion and winning mindset to everything he does, and I got a ton of value from his stories and insights. Without further ado, Steve Goldberg. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really looking forward to this. You know, Paul Ohls, one of our previous guests over at Sprinklr, said that we absolutely needed to have you on. The timing was 100% right, as you had just transitioned away from the revenue org at SalesLoft. You know, you've been a key player on some of the biggest names in software. And I know from others that you were at the forefront of a lot of significant deals in the early history of companies like Salesforce, deals that changed the trajectory of your career, and I would argue the cloud landscape, some might say. So I wanted to dive into a few of those today, but before we kind of delve into the specifics of that first deal, I'd love if you could just share a little bit about where you were in your career and your life at that time. What drove you? What challenges were you facing personally and professionally? And kind of what was your mindset?
Yeah. Well, first of all, if I just kind of step back, like when I was in college, I was a baseball player and I was a catcher and I was a psychology major and I was really into psychology. And I wanted to become a sports psychologist because your job as a catcher is to manage the, you know, the team. And you go out, talk to the pitcher on the mound and they're in a tough frame of mind. And I didn't realize how important psychology was until I got into sales. And because you got to be able to read people, you got to be able to read yourself, you got to be able to motivate yourself. You got to, you know, be in a good frame of mind. You got to pick yourself up, you got to pick others up. And so when I had started my career, I thought sales was about being as aggressive as you possibly can. I just had this connotation about sales where it was somewhat of a negative connotation. Like, I did not want to admit I was a salesperson when I first got into sales. I was somewhat embarrassed because it had a negative connotation. But until one day I realized that salespeople's jobs are problem solvers. And they help solve company problems, also help solve people's problems, like the individuals that you're selling to. And you could actually help them grow their career and get promoted for making great decisions. And so when I started to realize there was more to sales besides just selling somebody a product or a service, but it was really about solving problems, then I started to realize, yeah, I am a salesperson. And I, you know what? I am here to sell you something. But it's going to benefit you and your business, and it's going to benefit me and my business. And I always had this philosophy that you never want to have a winner or a loser in a conversation. You never want to, like, feel like, you know, you won over that deal. You want everybody to just feel good about the relationship. And so there was a point in my career when I was growing up I was a recruiter, and it was probably one of the best places to grow up in sales because what I realized was that you did so much for people, but when you're selling a recruiting service, you had to really simplify your message. And when I realized I had to just simplify my message, and I was just a young kid coming out of school, and I just had to, like, transition my mind from being like a college kid who had reconstructive surgery playing baseball to living in Lake Tahoe and trying to find myself to finding a company that was going to help transition me into the real world. I had to kind of be in a good mindset to be able to shift my thinking. And then I, you know, started recruiting for companies and all started to see enterprise software. And I started to see what enterprise software was. But at that point, enterprise software was client server. It was like you had to install a bunch of infrastructure at a company site. It was really hard. It was really hard for companies to get that result because there was just so much work that you had to do. And so one time something had shifted for me in my career. I was working at a company called Siebel. And I'm going to get to your answer here in a second, but you asked me about mindset and kind of what was going through. So I want to kind of get to that point. But I was working for this company called Siebel, which was like, that was the elephant in the room. And they were like company everybody wanted to work for. I was trying to sell old infrastructure software to this company. And I put so much time and effort into it. And we're almost about to get the deal. And it was a $3.5 million deal. It was a $3.2 million deal to be exact. And we're almost there to get it. And I walked out of one meeting and they were talking about this small company called Salesforce.com and how much they love the company, how much they love the product, how much they love the people. And I walked out of that meeting and I remember the person who told me this, who was the hardest to convince that we should have, but she was finally convinced that they're going to go with us. But she told me how much she loved this company. As I walked out of the building, I get a call from a recruiter from Salesforce.com and that the SVP of sales is in Dallas and I was in San Antonio at the time, but I lived in Austin, but the company was in San Antonio, who wants to have dinner with me in Dallas. And I was like, this is crazy. Like, I just like heard about you for the first time. Salesforce at that time was probably $150 to $200 million company, small. Yeah, and I was like, no, I'm about to close this deal. I've been working for 2 years on this. And he convinced me to go with him. This guy's name was Paul Detmeyer. And I was going to have dinner with a guy named Tom Addis at the time. So I went. And when I realized in that conversation that this is when the cloud was coming, he explained the cloud. And Salesforce was, Siebel was trying to figure out how to get into the cloud. But the problem was they didn't know how to comp for it. So nobody was selling it. They were just selling infrastructure software. And so they're like, you got to come work here. This is the place. This is where the market's going. The market's shifting. And it was all about the cloud. And it works like Google. You just turn it on. It worked. Because I was used to infrastructure software. And when I started to realize what I was good at was solving people's problems and relating to people. But the hardest part about selling software was the software itself. So that was just a mindset for me. And I went and explained this to my wife. She was my fiance at the time. And then, you know, randomly, we were going on a trip to Utah. And I met, as I was thinking about doing this job, going to work for Salesforce, I met these three people that work for a company called DoubleClick that was bought by Google. And we were hiking with them. And they told me how incredible this product called Salesforce.com was. And that was just it. And so I ended up going. I'm going over there. But when I got there, I sat in sales training. And I just fell in love with, like, the philosophy on the company and the people at the company. And I was so passionate that I could sell this. That it product worked. And like, I think it's really important as a salesperson when you have that mindset, like, I'm gonna sell you something that I know is gonna work for you and it's gonna solve a problem for you and it's gonna help you and it's gonna benefit you in your career. And that's what I realized when I got to Salesforce. And that's when the light bulb just clicked. So then, yeah, I was going through a different phase. I was getting married. I had to start, you know, thinking for me and my wife, but I was just in a position now where I knew it wasn't just about being aggressive. It was about having a process around how you're going to help a customer evaluate your technology. The cloud was just coming in place. No one knew how to evaluate the cloud. No one knew how to do it. So you had to teach them how to evaluate, and you had to teach them how to implement, and then you had to teach them how to buy. So I had, at that point, Salesforce was just becoming a company that was selling to enterprises, moving from like an inside sales model. It was pretty early on and I had a big territory. And then we started to verticalize. And then I had the opportunity to go sell to like the biggest companies in the world, the Dells, the AT&Ts and the Walmarts. But I believed so much about what I said and I was so passionate about it that I was just, there was no stopping me. I was so focused. And so I'll just kind of pause there because that was the mindset I had. And when I think you have to be super confident that what you're going to sell is going to truly solve people's problems. Because if I sold anything to a company like Dell or AT&T in Texas that didn't work, I couldn't walk out of my house without getting stones thrown at me. I'd be the person that sold anything. And that was what I was against. So I had to find a company and a product and an executive team that I felt super confident about that I could solve and I could sell somebody that I would solve their problems.
I think it's interesting to hear you say that. You know, we're in this time right now, it's early 2024, you know, what's been perceived as a bloat in the industry on some level. And I think a lot of people becoming more and more dispassionate about what they're selling or actually not really caring about where they are. It's just about the comp. And you know, I think you make a very interesting point, which is the job becomes multiples easier if you actually believe in it. You feel almost in a way, and I've heard this quote a lot of times around, you know, some people think marketing is cheesy, selling is cheesy. You know, it's this really kind of cringeworthy thing for a lot of folks. But, you know, the one thing I've heard to reframe that is you have a responsibility to put as much effort into marketing and sales as possible if you actually believe what you're selling helps somebody, because you are benefiting a greater amount of people. And that sounds like the mentality that you kind of went into this for, which is all the serendipity of everyone saying they love this place, they love what they're doing here. And you're saying, yeah, you know what? I really feel like I need to get this into more people's hands.
Yeah. And only that, but you're right, because I was so confident that I knew it would solve their problems. But you said something where a lot of people now do think about, okay, if I sell this, they're calculating their comp. They're doing it just to make money. And I think if you go into it with that mindset, you're going into it for all the wrong reasons, and your customers will see that. They've got to be able to see. A customer needs to want, when you're doing big deals, a customer needs to see that you care as much about the problems that they have as they do. And if they think and they feel any inkling that you're in it just to make money, you lost their trust. And I do agree with you that I see it too much. I mean, so I went from being, you know, an enterprise salesperson to, you know, running teams to my last job, I was a chief revenue officer at a sales loft and took the company from like $50 million to $250 million. My previous company, you know, I ran the enterprise and verticalized that in North America. And, you know, I was like 200 to 400. And I've worked with so many different salespeople. I've touched pretty much, I can go on different places I've sold to in my career. I've touched pretty much every enterprise customer out there with one way or another with my team or a variety of salespeople. And I can tell you, there's not that many good salespeople out there. There's very few great salespeople out there. And now, B, you can be great one day and not so great the next day because what's going on in your life and your career, your personal life, there's so many things that go into that. But I think a lot of it is because you just have to truly care and you got to be in it for the right reasons. And if not, like, you can get lucky once, but how do you stay consistent and do it multiple times over and over and over? And how does it become muscle memory? Like, you've got to think and you've got to do things because you're learning every single day. You're meeting some incredible people. And every single person you talk to is a relationship that you should have for the rest of your career. And you want them, when you text them, when you email them, when you call them, to want to call you back, not to have to call you back.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. And actually, one of the best parts about hosting this podcast, The Windwire, where we actually go into a lot of those deals and experiences, it's amazing to see people in the comments when we post it, the customers who were a part of that deal, who were actually almost appreciative that this was a core memory in their life. Buying this piece of software or whatever else it is, they're cherishing it as much as the salesperson is talking about it. And I think that goes to show you.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you one example. Like, when I was living in Austin, like, Dell is the biggest out there, the biggest company out there growing up. And like, if I ever had a chance to have a meeting with Michael Dell, it was just like, I mean, it's such an incredible learning experience. Because you don't just walk into a meeting with Michael Dell and just show up unprepared. You don't walk into a meeting with Mark Benioff, who's the founder and CEO of Salesforce, and just show up unprepared. I mean, that's months and months and months of planning. You've got to think about every single angle. And so there's many experiences I can talk about within meetings that we've had there. But, you know, one thing came to my mind, and this is not with Mark or Michael, but it kind of is, I guess. So we were building a relationship with Dell. And we were trying to, you know, have Dell become a big customer of Sales Labs.
And what year is this?
This was probably 2007-ish, 2008. And we had some stop and starts, but they weren't using any of our technology. And they were a company that had very regional applications. So every region, they kind of built their own technology on like .NET and other capabilities. And so they had like different applications were kind of like nothing communicated with each other really. And so there was a guy who was the CIO, who was actually was the VP of IT in Europe. And then he became the CIO at Dell. And there was a meeting I had with him, and there are always these moments of truths that you remember in your career where you have a split second to actually make a decision on how you're going to react. And we were building this rapport across all of Dell, and then Mark Benioff would ask for, hey, what's going on? How's it going? And I would update Mark and send him an email across, you know, my boss, to my boss's boss, all the way up to Mark. And so many people had eyes on it, would get to Mark, and what he would do is he would pass it over to Michael Dell. Say, hey, here's what I'm seeing. What do you see? I don't want to speak for him, but something like that. So that had happened one time, and there was a, I get the call the next day from this, now the CIO at Dell, saying, I don't know who you are, but get up to Round Rock right now. And I was, it was a snowstorm. And I just said, all right, I get to meet with this guy. I don't know if I should say his name. I probably don't care, but I get to meet with him. And he just flew in from Europe. He was taking this global CIO role. And I get there and I see him sitting in his office, and he hands me a piece of paper with the email that I sent to Michael updating, I'm sorry, that I had sent to across my company, and it got to him from Michael Dell saying, hey, what's this? And he goes, you can't do this. You can't be sending my CEO emails with all this stuff you're doing within our company, and it has to stop right now. And I'm calling you up here to tell you it has to stop. And I sat there and said, I could have said, I'm sorry, I'm wrong, right? I'm going back to what I said earlier in the conversation. I was so passionate that I could solve their problem to globalize their applications for the first time and globalize their business and give them a view across everything, because I knew our technology would solve the problem for them. And they want to get a view across Walmart, for an example, across the world, to understand like what's going on across that company. And I said, you know what? It's not going to stop. In fact, I'm going to have to do it more often. I'm going to be sending these probably every week. And look, I can tell you this, and to this day, I think Mark Benioff is the most incredible CEO I've ever worked with. And I've had interactions with him and always made me better. And he just demanded perfection, and you had to deliver perfection. And I said to him, he cares so much about this relationship with you all that I have to update him. What am I going to say? No. In fact, he cares so much that I got to update him more, because he cares about this relationship with you all and building an incredible business and helping solve problems for you. And he genuinely cares. So it's going to happen more often. So I think we have one or two choices. You can fight it, or we can align together and make sure that the message is synced, and it's, you have the same message that I have, and we're communicating before the email goes out, and we're both sending it up at the same time. He looks at me, he goes, all right, look. He opened up, he goes, hey, there's going to be one or two things that are going to happen here. I'm either going to have the shortest tenure as CIO at this company, or I'm going to be the first CIO to globalize business processes here and be the longest tenured CIO here. And this is kind of like one of the first steps in doing that. I said, then let's partner, because I can help you and you can help me. And that's his motivation. And my motivation was, quite frankly, at what point wanted at the time to do one of the largest transactions in the cloud market and to really understand how to sell cloud software to some of the biggest companies in the world. That was my personal win, because I wanted to know how to do it. His was, he was moving to the US. He wanted to be the longest tenured CIO at Dell, because you got to care about the personal win for people. And mine was also to get on the map, right? But to do it because I was going to learn so much from this experience that I'd be able to be muscle memory to me. I didn't care as much about the paycheck as I did about the learnings that I would get from that and the relationships that I would build that to this day are some of my closest friends still. And so we did. He became the longest tenured CIO. We made sure that we were really solving a problem that was specific to their needs. We weren't selling them all these problems we were trying to solve. Remember, people didn't know how to buy cloud software. So we were going to help them be more agile, be more flexible, so they can change business process quickly, but they can have a governance in place, that they can have like a framework that they can build off and give the different regions and segments, you know, some flexibility to kind of run the business they wanted to do it, but have a view that they'd never had before and follow around their customer master. So we solved for that. And there was so many, there was another, many other scenarios there where one of our biggest competitors, so we got the sales deal. We got all the global sales teams. But we had an opportunity to get all the call center business too. And we very easily, we could have got like 35,000 call centers. We could have got that whole business. But we as a company decided not to. And when you're doing deals like this, when you're doing big deals, this isn't like me and my boss going to sell software to Dell. This is Salesforce and the company and Dell and the company coming together in a partnership. And this is the emerging of two companies, two cultures. And this is a market changing opportunity for both of us. And so it's not just me out there making my own decisions around, hey, we're going to go do this. So we had this opportunity after we got this piece, actually, as we were getting this piece of business, we could have expanded that to another 35,000 licenses in the call center. Our infrastructure, our technology, this is what makes Salesforce such a special company, is our technology was not ready to support all the API transactions in the call center. It just wasn't ready, especially a Dell call center, which is like thousands and thousands of transactions every minute probably. And so I was with, you know, working with the founder, one of the founders of Salesforce, and, you know, had a meeting with Mark. We're going to meet a bunch of executives at Dell. And we were going to convince them that we can't handle this part of the business, but we can handle the sales part of the business. Another big company wanted this other piece of the business. And we opened the door and said, you take it, because we're not ready for it. And so we had a big meeting where we said, look, we're not ready for this. This is what we're really good at. We're going to take the sales business and we're going to solve this problem for you. And that other company was implemented and never really truly solved their problem. But eventually Salesforce came and they got that business when they were ready for it. We weren't ready for it at the time. And if I had sold that, I would have never been able to sell anything ever to Dell or anybody that ever worked at Dell that went to work at another company, because I would be known as the person that shoved software down their throat when they weren't ready to buy it or our capabilities weren't ready to consume it. And it was incredible that our founders and the most senior executives at Salesforce also acknowledged that. Like, we just didn't want to get a massive, massive deal just to get a massive, massive deal. If we knew we couldn't make it really work and solve for them, it would have been such a distraction. And I'll tell you, that is the difference of what makes great companies great and good companies mediocre, because then you have to spend all your time. You got all your customers over here doing one thing, but then you got these other companies over here and they're taking you down a wrong path for your product roadmap. And I learned so much from that in my career around, you know, not just taking a deal to get a logo, but taking a deal because what they're buying is very much aligned to the product strategy and the product direction of a company. And so going back to like now as a CRO, as I build sales processes are designed and built that you're going to sell your product or services based on your wheelhouse as a company and a product and the problems you solve, and makes everybody else compete with you. And so you're streamlining that. So then, you know, you got a very light tight path to your product roadmap. So you're not sending your product people in a thousand different directions as well. So going back to like, you know, what do you learn off? Not only was this like a market changing opportunity, I think, for the company at that point, one of the biggest cloud deals when the cloud was being developed, but it was also a learning too. Definitely a big learning for me in my career.
I'm amazed just hearing it. Like, one of the parts that is kind of hard to digest a little bit, and obviously intuitively what you're saying makes sense of, hey, it's just as important to understand what you're saying no to, and the whole concept of focus. Almost antithetical to everything someone like you in that position is looking for, partially, and you know, the bank account is important. And, you know, of course, I'm sure you know, and you've probably experienced the situation yourself personally, which is everyone's got to hit your numbers, whether you're an individual, whether you're the CEO of the company, whether you're the CRO of the company. To say no to something is putting that on the line in a really intense way. And I can imagine that's just a really hard decision that actually requires a lot of qualitative thinking.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. At the end of the day, like, it's one thing, you can't miss a step. If you miss a step, you're eventually going to get burned. Something's not going to happen. There's no shortcuts. And you got to, I personally think you have to think longer term. Like, you got to think past the quarter, past the, you know, this, you got to think past the company. And you got to think about what's the right thing to do. And it goes back to, though, what I was saying earlier is that it can't, your customers, and not only your customers, but your sales team, your sales engineers, your consultants, your partners, if they see a salesperson that's just in it for a buck and they're super, super selfish and just cares about how much money's going in their bank account, then everybody's going to see that and they're not going to want to work with you. You know, they're just not. And I think some people have it in them and some people don't. I mean, like, you know, it's funny. I've heard, you know, there's so many people as I've kind of moved up in my career and been into management, tell me, yeah, they were responsible for, you know, biggest deals in the company history. They did all these deals, and you find out they were maybe an overlay or maybe they got some credit for it. And it's, you know, I was asking someone the other day, very senior person at a big company. He runs development. And I asked him, he said, like, how do you know if you're interviewing a good developer? Like, I have no idea. I would never be able to know. But I could tell if I'm interviewing a good salesperson. And him and I, we surf. We do a lot of surfing, like, you know, like, and he's like, if I'm talking to you about surfing and you're telling me how to put your feet, you're telling me how to move your body, you're telling me how to get over waves, you know the details of something, then I know that you know what you're doing because you do it a lot. Like, a developer is the same thing. And like, when you're interviewing a salesperson, I think a lot of sales managers get lazy and they're like, oh, you were the person that sold this deal, I'm gonna bring you over here, versus like, hey, tell me a little bit about it. Tell me how you experienced meetings like this. Tell me about, you know, how you were able to find the personal win for somebody. Help me understand like some of the business decisions your company had to make and the trade-offs that they had to make. And tell me about some of the meetings you had with some of the most senior executives and explain that to me. And you've got to dig in to truly understand if people know how to truly do this. Truly do what they say they can do, because if you don't do that, eventually you're going to find that they weren't the right person for the role. And that's why you got to hire slow, but frankly, and fire fast sometimes.
No, it's I think it is interesting. I totally agree with you that the people who know the details, right, to your point around like your emails to Mark Benioff and that at CIO, what you're ultimately trying to do is show that you know what you're talking about. And that really helps everybody else, you know, within a company. And, you know, you're someone who, and I was excited to have you on, of course, because as mentioned, you're someone who actually has closed those deals and you broke kind of the seal for yourself in a lot of ways. You know, even that conversation you mentioned earlier, that took a lot of guts. There's a lot of fear involved in doing something that you haven't done before. And there's a lot of people out in the market right now who are even managing who've never actually done it before. And yeah. So how are you supposed to coach to that? Now, I did want to get into, you know, you talked a little about the Dell deal. I wanted to talk about one more deal that you mentioned beforehand was something really impactful for you, and that was with AT&T. And so clearly at this point, you've already tasted success. I don't know if you put any numbers on it, but I don't know how much was on the line for you in that first one. Clearly a lot. Would love to understand what made this one really game-changing and special for you off the bat. What was the company going through?
Yeah. So it was a different phase of the company, because when I was selling Dell, it was all about Salesforce automation. And it was about globalizing their sales processes around. So I think it's really important to figure out, you got to align where the company is going and you've got to go sell where they're going, sell what they're best at. And at that point, that was the big focus of Salesforce. This is early in the early days. So when we, and by the way, there was three deals we did at Dell. It wasn't just one big one. It was three or four deals. And they were all good size that grew quite a bit. So you got to be able to deliver too. You got to be able to follow through on what you say you're going to do. So it's not just around getting the deal, but it's around helping them implement, helping them navigate through themselves to make it work and be successful. Because that's the difference of selling client server technology versus, you know, cloud at that point. Now, AT&T was different. AT&T, we were not going to replace. They were using Siebel at this time. We were not going to replace that. It was just too hard. But where Salesforce was going at that point was we shifted, because what one thing that made Salesforce really unique was the flexibility of our platform, that you can build all these other business applications on our platform and be much more agile. So we were working with this company on how do we help them build all these other applications around, you know, the revenue process and do it much more agile, much more flexible, and, you know, partner with like the Accentures and the Deloitte of the world to help deliver a lot of those capabilities as well. And at that point, Salesforce was getting to a point where we were starting to work with the big SIs. they had an opportunity to do a lot with our platform because it was so flexible and agile, and that they can really build off of that. And so where we were going at the time was around force.com. So we were working for a long time, and this company, AT&T, had no Salesforce business at all at that point. And they were like, all right, you just sold Dell, now go figure out if we can do something with AT&T. And it was a very challenging, AT&T is like a big holding company because there's lots of business parts of AT&T. But in this case, we worked for many, many times. It was in New Jersey, in Middletown, New Jersey, and spent many nights in Middletown. And I remember sometimes flying in there, it was dark, and flying back, it was dark, going to the airport in Newark. But we had to really show them we cared and build those relationships and, you know, convince them there was another way to do it, a faster way to do it, a more efficient way to build applications. And we were selling, this one guy was the SVP of IT for the business, who was a very challenging person to sell to. He was incredible. He demanded like respect. He demanded excellence. And so I'd sit there and just build a relationship with him, again, trust me. And so we were getting up toward the end of the fiscal year, and it didn't seem like we were going to do a deal. And so my birthday is in January 24th, and our fiscal year ends January 31st. And so I was telling my wife, I was like, I wasn't 40, it was my 39th birthday, I believe, at the time. I was telling my wife that, hey, look, I don't think we're going to get this deal. But fortunately, I can do something for my birthday this year. And so she said, okay, I got this idea. We're going to go out to this place in Texas. It's called Bandera, Texas, and it's Dude Ranch. And we'll just go for the weekend. And it was, the fiscal year ended on a Monday. It was the 31st. And I get a call from the head of procurement at AT&T on Thursday night. And he says, I got good news and I got bad news. You know, the good news is, look, we want to do this deal. The bad news is we're going to have to like get an MSA signed and a contract signed. We have like 3 days to do it. And it was a really big one.
How much money is on the line for you here, roughly?
So that's how I explained it. It was a lot. And I explained that to my wife. That's how I had to explain it to her. And it was a lot. I would have been well over my number for the year. You know, and I think that year I ended up number two in the world at Salesforce. And so it was a big one, if you can imagine that. And I do think Salesforce has some of the best salespeople that have come through there in the years. And so I go to my wife. I'm like, look, I got good news and I got bad news. I go, the good news is she was in the kitchen and they were like, we're packed. We're leaving the next morning to go on this trip. And I'm like, I don't think I'm going to be able to go. But the good news is I think we're going to get this deal done. I was just trying to calculate all my commissions so I can explain it to her. And she's like, well, I got good news and I got bad news. I was planning a surprise party for you and I invited your entire family from all over the country to come and all of our friends are going to be there. We're going to have like 80 people at this in Bandera, Texas. And so you kind of have to go. And then we called up and I'm like, is there cell phone service there? And there's like, there's no cell phone service. It's a Dude Ranch. The only phones we have are one of those phones that are on the walls, those rotary phones that have the big cord. And I was like, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to go. And what am I gonna tell her? But she was incredible. She's like, look, I get it. This is what we signed up for and just figure it out. And I'll tell you one thing, it's really important in your career to have like a very supportive family in times like this, in times like, you know, it really is. Because so I was not able to show up to my birthday and all my family and friends were there and I could not go. And I stayed home the entire 3 days. And that was, this deal fell apart so many different times and we negotiated this thing around the clock 24/7. And we ended up getting it closed on January 31st. But it fell apart a lot and we ended up closing it. And they got home and I was able to show my wife, we got it closed. And I couldn't talk to her the entire time because there was no cell phone service out there. So they didn't know if I was coming or going. I'm like, every day I'm like, yeah, I might come, I might not come, I might come. And I never made it. And, you know, but I was at a point in my career where it was like, at some points in your career, you have to make sacrifice. And it's a hard thing to do because, look, family is super, super important to me. And, like, right now, for an example, I'm on a break. Like, I'm transitioning out of my last company. And for the first time, I'm just taking a break. There's a lot of opportunity I'm seeing out there, but I'm really just taking a break. I've never really done this before because I need to take a deep breath because I've run so hard my entire career. And I'm super competitive, and I love being on the field. But I've got so many experiences like that that are great experiences. And I could call any of those people that were involved in that deal, whether it's a customer, whether it's anyone that I worked with at Salesforce, because we were in the trenches together and we did it together. And those are the things you always remember. But, I made a sacrifice. And would I do it again? Under the same circumstances, potentially. And like now, as someone who's leading teams, I got to tell you, like, that's what it takes to be successful. It really does. When you're growing up in your career and you're doing deals like this, and like, I've seen so much entitlement out there in the market where, like, I think for a while, a lot of these salespeople and managers, like, they kind of feel like, in a way, like, they're very entitled. Like, you owe me for working for you and working for you here. What do you mean I got to take a call after hours, or I got to get on this plane? I think as a leader, though, you want people to want to win for you. And I think that's really important. Having that culture and creating that culture as a leader, like once I feel like I don't want to win for my boss and my managers and my leaders, then I'm out. Once I lose trust, I'm out. But if I feel like they're in it with me and we're winning and we're doing this together, that's always been my philosophy. It's a team sport. Then that's fine. Then I'm in. But I do think there's a lot of people out there that have to wake up a bit and realize that, life isn't easy. To be great, you've got to put the effort in. You got to work hard. It's the details that matter. And you got to care and you got to do the work. Like, you're not going to walk into a test, hopefully, and not study for it. If you don't, you're not, unless you're like, you have such incredible IQ that you remember everything, whatever you call, those people that have photographic memories. But that wasn't me. I had to study. I had to work hard. Like, and so I just think there's too many people out there right now that are super entitled, and they're getting a big wake-up call because the market right now is tough, and it's all about production, and it's all about doing the right thing. It's putting the effort in and putting the work in. If you don't do it, then you're going to be the one with a lot of different jobs on your resume, because there's no more tolerance for that. And so I just think also kids coming out of college right now, I have a nephew at UT. I mean, he's got three jobs. Like, my kids, I'm going to make them work. My dad always made me work. We had a wholesale foods business. I was like driving trucks and cutting meat, and he just instilled it in me. And so I think it's really important that, like, that's just where the market is now. And it's coming full circle back to that.
And you never want to sound like the kind of like curmudgeon, who's like, kids these days don't want to work, because every generation has always said that about the generation after them. And so, it's like at the risk of sounding like that, yeah, there clearly are all these moments of sacrifice. And I think, with regards to the AT&T story, yeah, it's going to look pretty embarrassing if you don't close that deal and you cancel on all these people. And then you're going to feel like the real sucker.
Right. But it goes back to, right, I don't want to come off like that, but I've seen it so much. I've really seen it where it's not that they don't want to work. It's just their people are entitled. And I think you just got to put the effort in. And like, if I didn't close that deal, if I wasn't doing the little things, but that deal didn't happen because of the work we did over that weekend. That deal happened because of the 6 months prior to that. It's because they had the trust. They had the respect. You didn't miss a step. You did all the right level of effort. You did the work. You spent the time in doing the work. So you can actually get into a deal like that. And so that deal the last 4 days, those deals don't happen because of what you do then. It happens because of all the other things that you do to make it happen. And so that's what I mean. It's like, you're right about what you said. It's like, you don't want to come out. It's a good point. Like, people say, well, people didn't, every generation, and I don't want to come off like the older guy saying that. I've just seen it too much that I do think the market's coming a bit full circle like in that.
Yeah. I mean, there's, of course, the famous quote, I think it's attributed to Thomas Jefferson of, yeah, I'm a great believer in luck, and I find the harder I work, the more I have of it. That's one. And I actually saw a study recently that showed, they talked about the different types of luck. And these are scientists trying to study, what exactly does luck mean? And one example of luck actually is this idea of like kinetic energy. If you're in the science, you know, if you're a scientist and you're in the lab all the time testing things, guess what? You're more likely to stumble upon a solution if you're just testing a lot of things, if you're in the lab a lot. If you're in the lab once a day for a few hours, you're probably not going to stumble upon that weird solution that actually ended up working. And so I think there is this notion of like, yeah, you just kind of have to do it with the expectation that, yeah, you're probably going to fail a variety of times. And it's something I did want to ask you because you talked about, oh, this AT&T deal as an example almost fell apart a bunch of times. And I'm sure the same happened with Dell and a lot of other deals. There's an emotional management component to that for yourself, but I'm curious if you have any specific even examples in your mind of, yeah, why do these things typically fall through in your eyes? And what are the kinds of things that you do when they end up falling through? You know, do you have any examples of that?
Yeah, I mean, you got to find a path. You always got to find a path because there are terms you're working on that are just non-negotiables. And like one of it could be like you put together a deal structure that like we put together a deal structure that we thought we were aligned on and they weren't. And they ripped it apart and basically said, this isn't happening. This is like not even like close to how we were thinking about it. You're way too much money. The way how you're doing this is structured. So then we had to go back to like our senior leadership team and be like, they just essentially threw up all over this deal. And we had like an hour to put it back together. Because the clock is ticking, like it's like your end of the year. It's like if it happens, you know, a minute after midnight, the deal's not, doesn't impact the year. So the clock is ticking. So you're having to like put the deal back together, getting your company to agree to the deal that you think that the customer is going to do. And you got to like truly listen and say, like, we'll work with them to figure out like what gets this thing done. Then you got to sell it internally to the most senior people in your company and say, and they don't love it really. So you gotta be able to explain why it's the right deal and why it will get done. And then you gotta go back to them and then all of a sudden it throws something else at you. And I remember there was just one time where we were getting in the middle of all of that. And me and my boss at the time were putting together a spreadsheet and we couldn't get the spreadsheet to work. I was working on the spreadsheet. We were on like a GoToMeeting at the time. And I was working on, and the spreadsheet just wouldn't work. And we had to get on the phone with like the most senior people at Salesforce to show them what the deal looked like. And we couldn't get the spreadsheet to work. And we had like 10 minutes. And I'm like, everyone's like, I'm on this GoToMeeting where all these other people are like yelling at me. And I couldn't get the spreadsheet to work. And I had to like, I literally got out. I shut it down. I jumped in the pool and it was in the middle of the winter. So it was cold. And I just had to like calm down for that. And then my boss told me he was throwing chairs at through his house. And then I got back. I said, all right, let me figure this thing out. I started a new spreadsheet, got it together. Finally got on, got our company to align on it, went back to the customer, and we got a bit closer, right? But if I didn't have the relationship with this guy, like sitting outside of his office, spending the time with him, he would have just given up. He was ready to walk away and give up. And there is a truth to you are going to lose a deal many, many times before you win it. Meaning you've got to understand and feel what it's like to truly lose. And every big deal out there, you've lost. Like you have to feel like this deal is not happening. It is over. And then you got to like, going back to psychology, and this is I think what I do pretty well in kind of managing my teams and myself, is like figuring out a path and just be like, and that's where relationships matter because like we came up with a path.
Yeah, but you don't want to be desperate and be like, oh, no, you know, going back on your word.
Right, but you want to find a path. But you also can't throw any Hail Marys at the end of the year. Like if you don't do the right things, eventually you don't have the right to ask for the business. You don't have the right when you lose it to come back and get it. And so, you know, like there are plenty of times that there's so many stories in every deal I've ever done where you're going to lose it and you're going to feel like you lost it and you got to pick it back up the next day. And you're usually going to lose it in the morning and then you spend the rest of the day picking it back up. And it happens all the time. And there's been so many scenarios where, you know, if you talk to people that I've worked with in the past where they've come to me and the deal's been done and we figure out how to pull it back together. And sometimes, but I think you got to know when it's done. You don't always know. Like some of the deals I've done, there have been a couple of times where I really thought it was done. And I've been okay with it. You've got to be mentally and emotionally okay with it. Like, and you really, truly have to be. You got to feel that way. And so in that scenario, we ended up, I'm like, oh, great. I got the deal structure. He agreed I'm going to go on my birthday. And then all of a sudden it was like Saturday night and he throws a ball over it. I'm like, okay, I guess I'm not going to go to Bandera, Texas. And we spent all day and all night putting this deal back together. I was more worried about that than I was. So, you know, there's been or there's a business term you can't get over that's super important to them. Or there's like, or you lose somebody. Like that one AT&T, we had to wake up their chief technology officer. We had to wake him up in the middle of the night to get his approval on the deal too. That was another thing that happened.
How do you wake someone up in the middle of the night?
You ask someone there to do it.
Yeah, you're not on the hook.
You asked someone there to do it. And they woke him up. And wherever he was, I remember it was like 2 a.m. because if we were on the West Coast, that was West Coast time. It was 2 a.m. on the East Coast or something like that. And yeah, we had to get him out of bed.
I can imagine it's like, that is literally worst case scenario for him. But it's funny. I think, you know, you kind of get to a point. And one thing I've heard, you know, one of the most important things in life or one way to like really be successful is to care 100% and 0% at the same time, right? It's kind of like a bit of a paradox. But it goes back to what you're saying, which is like you care so much, you want to make it happen completely. But you care so little that you're emotionally detached in a way that you're going to try to problem solve and you're also willing to lose in a way. And that's like the balance I think that is so hard for most people, right? Humans to even try to do.
And by the way, I did use the fact that it was my birthday and my entire family was my parents, my brothers, everyone came out there. And so like, you're not giving up either if I'm not giving up.
Yeah, no, I like that. Exactly. Have them won over on them a little bit. But
yeah, I use that plenty of times.
But I am curious, sure, like from these deals, this Dell deal, the AT&T deal, you know, in what ways did they change your career personally and kind of reset what you thought was possible?
Well, one, you know, if you knew me growing up, I never would have ever thought I'd be doing deals like that. I never thought I would ever even know how to do them. And it does become like muscle memory. It becomes like you can just like walk in a room, you can see how these things start to unfold. And so, you know, one is just the relationships that I built through that probably helped me get my next few jobs and helped me grow my career and moved into other places in my career. And, you know, it was a pivotal moment in my career where it was like, you know, I just learned how to do them. I learned how to do those deals and it helped, you know, put me in spots in my career that when people had needs like that, they thought of me. And I think it's important that like, if you always do the right things and you typically won't have to look for a job with a resume, you know, because people want to work with you. It goes back to what I was saying. If they know you care about them and you care about the personal growth of all the people around you, customers, your support staff, your sales engineer, your boss, your value engineers. There's been many people in my career that I've worked with 3 or 4 companies. And you bring people with you or you get brought in with other people because there's a trust. And so that's how it really changed the trajectory of my career. And that's one thing that I, to me, is a big measurement of, you know, a lot of people. Do people want to work with you? Do they want to bring you places? Do they want to come where you're at? And to me, like the best part of my career, when I left my last company, for an example, I've seen now people develop like I went through. I've seen salespeople, I've seen SDRs going to sales. I've seen them go from a girlfriend to getting married, to having kids, to being the same person, their trajectory is going from like an SDR to a manager, or to a salesperson, to an enterprise salesperson, to a manager. And like when I left that company, you know, they had people call me up. I'm like, we're talking about these types of experiences. You know, we're talking about, hey, remember this. Like I learned so much in that situation. And I love now seeing them, you know, people like that come to me and be like telling these stories about their experiences and how I kind of coach them through it and help them in their career. And, you know, to me, that's where it changed because I've experienced it myself. I want to see other people experience it.
That's the most rewarding part. You know, one thing I'm trying to be better about here, right? We talk to all these very, very successful leaders, founders, CEOs, CROs. And, you know, we're usually talking about these big wins. And I think for a lot of people, it always seems kind of up and to the right, generally, because you paper over everything else. I was curious to ask you, you've been around the block. You've been in some amazing companies. You've closed amazing deals. you had all these achievements, obviously as a seller, revenue leader, you know, you're kind of the scapegoat too. But I am curious, like, you know, are there any specific mistakes or setbacks that you've experienced in your career, and how did you navigate through that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you learn the most from your mistakes than you do your successes. You know, you learn the most from your failures, from the deals that you lost and the deals that you win. And, you know, like, so like, yeah, I mean, like anything, like I've made mistakes, and you know, I'm trying to, you know, it's not like I can point to one.
Yeah, and the, these could be career mistakes. You know, I think people right now are going to the wrong company in some cases and you know, wrong position.
Yeah, so I think I've made some of the mistakes that I've made, and I've looked at them, are they mistakes? So like when I left one company, when I left Salesforce, I was just ready to leave. And I was running away. I wasn't running to. And I was running to a company that I knew nothing about. I followed somebody that I probably shouldn't have. I felt that way. But then I also look at it and say, you know what? I learned so much in that year and a half going to this company that it was an experience, and there were experiences that made me to who I am today. And, you know, the product wasn't really what I thought it was. There was a lot of issues with the product. There were a lot of issues with the makeup of the board. There was a lot of issues with a lot of different things that I had no idea. I didn't do the research. I just was running away from something. And so, but I don't think that was a mistake. I think that was, at the time I felt it was, but I learned a lot. I learned a lot there. And I always kind of lead with integrity. Like there was a point in my career too, it was another company deal we were working on with. I've always learned from managers that I would never work for again to realize why I wouldn't work for them. And there was one person in particular that I probably learned the most from, because it was something that I would just never manage, like this person managed. He managed by fear. And I remember there was this, I'll leave you this. So there's one meeting we had when I was at Salesforce, actually. And I told you, some of these meetings with the most senior execs at your company and other companies, like you prepare for months and months and months. And it's, sometimes it's pretty scripted, right? So we go into this meeting, and I'm not going to say the company. It was the CEO of a big company. And there was all these new people that had come in from this other company that work now at Salesforce. And we prepared so much for this meeting, and this new leader came in and didn't feel like he was close enough to this. He shows up at the last minute and pulls me aside into this other conference room. And was telling me how I'm going to run the meeting. And he was having me drink soda because he didn't think I was like energized enough. And I was going to kick the meeting off. And everybody else was in the other conference room. I could see him across the way. And he brings me to this other conference room, and he has me like prepare how I'm going to handle the meeting, what I'm going to say to the CEO. And he had me go over and over. It was like 5 a.m, 6 a.m, 7 a.m. But no one in the other room knew what I was going to do because we had already prepped and they were prepared for a different meeting. And I think he was trying to prove his value. So I get to the meeting and he's sitting in the back of the room and I'm getting ready to kick the meeting off. And I look at him and I look at everybody else. And it was a moment of truth. It was one of those same moments of truth where I could, it was like the same time, end of court, you know, trying to do a big deal. And I looked in the room, and I remember sitting in front of the conference room table. I looked at him. He was texting in the back. And I remember, and I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to say what I said, but I said, no, I'm not doing it. I'm doing the meeting that everybody was prepared for, not this meeting. After the meeting, I quit. I told him, I'm done. This isn't the place I signed up for. It's not for me anymore. And then I was running away, and I went to this other company without really knowing much about it, right? But I think everybody makes those decisions in their career where sometimes you do run away from something and you learn from it. And what I've learned in my career is I try not to run away from something. I try to run to something. And I think it's important to run to something. And I was just made an emotional decision. I lead with integrity. I didn't feel like I was being managed with integrity. And why it wasn't working for somebody that I wanted to win for, that I respected. And it was time for me to go. And, so I did. And was it a mistake? You know?
I think it's the difference between a mistake and a regret. It's only a regret if you weren't able to learn from it. Whereas it's forgivable. And it's I mean, it is really hard right now. You mentioned about like opportunities in the market. It's hard to distinguish on a personal level for every single person of, am I running away from this or am I running to something else that's better? Because everything has kind of marks on it a little bit right now. Nothing is truly easy at the moment, to your point on hard work. And so it takes a lot of soul searching to understand, am I running away or, you know, am I having a grass is greener mentality? Or is there genuinely something exciting out there?
I think you know, and only you know, when you're running away versus you're running to it. It's hard. I mean, I talk to a lot of people now that, you know, are in positions where like, hey, I want to go, I'm leaving, I'm going here. And you're like, well, why? Well, for this reason. But it's never like, why are you going there? It's like, why more? It's like, why are you running away from where you're at right now? And I think right now is like, you got to stick it out a bit and just kind of, you know, just kind of see what develops in the market, because the market's a little challenging right now and there's a lot of uncertainty. But this is also a great time to go to a great place and like make your mark there too. So I just think you want to be thoughtful that you're, I always like to go through this effort. It's like I have a piece of paper and I put a line down and a line across, and then the top left, it's, what do I like to do? Top right is, what am I really good at? Top bottom left is, what am I not good at? And bottom right is, what do I hate to do? And I try to be doing the things that I'm good at, that I like to do, things that I'm not good at, that I want to get better at, and try to avoid some of the things that I just hate to do. And but the thing is, when you go through that exercise, you got to be intellectually honest with yourself and give it to other people, because then it helps kind of guide some of those conversations. But you just got to be honest with yourself, and you can figure it out. But it's okay to make a mistake too.
Yeah, that's part of a long career. You know, just to kind of close out here, one thing that you've talked about a bunch in this conversation in terms of, yeah, you learned so much from working with folks like Mark Benioff. I think people are just such a critical component of this. You already mentioned, you know, are there people you want to close a deal for? You've talked about some of these mentors I've heard before, you know, Susan St. Ledger, David Nitsky, Jim Steele. You know, is there anything you could share about how their mentorship transformed your approach to leadership or your job? Are there any kind of specific stories or lessons that stick out in terms of key lessons from them?
Yeah, I mean, they help you come up with the decisions. So they're your decisions. They don't dictate and tell you what decisions you have to make. Like, they're there to support you. They're there with you. They're not there telling you what to do and how to do it. Like, they've acknowledged that, like, you've got to make it your own. And they give you the rope, right? They don't like telling you what to do. And they understand how to manage you to your strengths, and how to motivate you, not dictate how you're going to do something. And they lead by example. And they're just people you want to be around. Like, I can call any of them now and I have a conversation that's not related to anything work-wise for a while. And, you know, they just relate to you.
Is there anything in particular that you'd point to in terms of kind of each of those individuals or anybody else that you see as kind of like a critical stepping stone?
Yeah, so I always learn something every time I talk to them too. Like, I talked to Susan the other day and she gave me a great idea in terms of how to think about my want to go next, in terms of like, what are some like big buckets of things I've done in my career and what are some big buckets I haven't done that I want to do, and how to think about it like that. Like, you know, have I gone through a fundraising event, or have I sold a company, or have I, you know, verticalized, or have I, you know, gone from cloud to on-prem, like in buckets like that. And that's just one example. Like, but I always think about that, you know. And I talked to Dave Renitsky, he just helps me untie knots, like in my mind. So I called him up with a scenario and he lets me kind of vent for a minute. It's always been that way. And then he'll be like, well, have you thought about this? And Jim is more like, you know, when you're talking to Jim, when Jim is like, knows everybody. So Jim would be like, you can't walk down the street in like the Bay Area without like 20 people stopping Jim. But he's just such a good person. And for all the reasons, because he's just like, he's just always there for you if you ever need him. And Jim would be like, you know, if I called Jim and like I was thinking about something, and he'd be like, hey, well, have you thought about this? You know, and so, you know, and then there's like Patrick Blair is another one. He's a, you know, CRO over at Workday now. And he's just like an incredible guy where like, he's more like, he's not, like I said something to him the other day, he's like, he's not afraid. Like I told him something, and he's not afraid to, he just punches you in the face. Like, yeah, but you were wrong because of this. Like, you're saying it wrong because you should have been thinking about it like that. You know, so like, and a lot of times you want advice, you call people because you want you want them to tell you something that you already want to be, that you're already convinced of. But I think you got to call somebody and ask them something because you want to get the real guidance and direction. Not just, sometimes you're like, all right, I feel like this. I'm going to call someone that feels like this. It's going to help me feel better about this thing. Versus someone who's going to truly give you real advice and something to think about. And not just tell you what you want to hear. And so I think that's really important. And that's, so those are those types of relationships that I've got. And like when I was working for Dave Vernitsky, he had his forecast call every day at every Friday at 9 a.m. Central. And you had to be prepared. You had to know every little detail about everything. Because in my experience, and those, like, you might get invited back twice, but you're not going to get invited back a third time. You just got to know the people just like, they just demand, like, not like demand respect. They're just perfectionists. And like, you just got to be prepared. You got to know everything. So then I would back into that. And now that's how I've taken a lot from that. You know, and the example I told you about someone else who kind of told me, you got to speak like this and you got to say like this and you got to present like this. That doesn't work for me. Those are the managers that I would never, but what they taught me is I don't want to be like that. I'm not going to lead like that.
Yeah, I think it doesn't work for most people, if we're being honest, in that respect, except for the most rigid of individuals. But
right.
But no, I think it's a great lesson. There is truly something to learn from everyone. And I think the benefit of going through a career like you have, and you know, I think people want to finish their career very early, but the benefit of doing something and being in multiple companies and being longer and working with great people is you have these people to call on for the rest of your life that you continue to turn back to on, especially if you've developed a good reputation.
You know, it's funny. Someone told me the other day, got some great advice. Someone who was, you know, came back and now he's CEO of a big company. And because I'm like taking a little bit of a break and he took a break and I'm like, tell me why you want to come back. Because you said everybody wants to retire early, but why? He's like, think about it. Songwriters and singers, that's what they do for a living. And some do it until they can't. They're on stage singing and playing music and writing songs. It's what they do. They're songwriters. Investors like to invest and they're going to invest until they can't, but they're going to invest until who knows how long. They're not just retiring. So like eventually if you do what you do this job, I do my job. Like you're competitive, like you got to keep your mind going and you're competitive, you want to be in the field. So when people say, yeah, I want to get done early, for what reason? It's fun, you got to have fun with it. You got to do it because it's enjoyable, because you're working around, you're hanging out with great people, you're learning every day. And you know, you get to experience, travel around the world and meet people and see other cultures. And you know, like it's fun.
Yeah, there's a longevity aspect to it of like, you know, can you establish something that does actually make you want to be in the game? Or if you don't have that inherently, can you find something about the process that you love? Can you find something about the learning that you love with it? Because you're going to last a lot longer and you're probably going to even be more successful in the short term too, as a benefit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm saying it now. I mean, I'm enjoying taking this little break. You know, I love, like, but I also think throughout your day when you're working, like I do a lot of yoga. You got to have an outlet, right? You got to have something that gets you that outlet. You got to be able to, if you have a family, spend time and be present with your family. You know, you got to do those things. Otherwise, you will get burnt out.
It's hard. I think it's a hard balance for everyone. And I think, you know, like I said, past few years, we're all looking for an easy out. It's totally logical. You want an easy out. You're kind of like, wouldn't it be nicer if I didn't have to do this anymore? I don't know if that easy out really exists anymore. And so I think it's really important, you know, for me, everyone else to understand, hey, what can we do that actually makes us want to be in the game longer? And someone like you probably is a little bit, you know, for just being honest, a little bit addicted to the game. You like the juice, you like the juice. It's hard to get out of the action.
Yeah.
Look, I appreciate the time, Steve. This was a fantastic conversation and it was really good to hear about your deals.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Enjoyed the discussion.
Yeah. Thanks as always for joining us on another episode of The Windwire. We'd appreciate it if you could share it on LinkedIn, Twitter, and rate us or leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Helps others discover the show and join our growing community. Our contact info is in the show notes, including our show email. You can see all episodes at thewindwire.com and in your favorite podcast player. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.